You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Ellsberg called Edward Snowden's leak of documents on NSA surveillance the most significant in American history. Mr. Ellsberg was 40, had a PhD, and was a respected economist when he leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971, while Edward Snowden, who was not quite 30 when he leaked the NSA files, is a very different story. Luke Harding, a journalist at the British Guardian, examines that story in his new book called The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man. Vintage has published it, and I'm very pleased it has brought Luke Harding to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
A few years ago, the world's most wanted man was Osama bin Laden, and now it's Edward Snowden?
Yeah, it's amazing how the world turns, how the cosmos changes. Osama bin Laden is gone, and we have a new enemy, or actually whistleblower, from my perspective. And yeah, he's stuck in Moscow.
Were you among the reporters who interviewed Edward Snowden before The Guardian broke the story in June of last year?
I didn't interview him. My colleague Ewan McCaskill, who was instrumental in the writing of this book, met Snowden in Hong Kong and spent 6 days with him, many hours talking to him about why he'd done what he did. And of course, Glenn Greenwald as well, my former Guardian colleague, was there too.
And he's kind of criticized this book because you haven't interviewed Snowden.
Well, Glenn fired off a hostile tweet, as Glenn sometimes does, before he'd actually read the book. And subsequently, he's been conciliatory because he's read it and even says it's quite good in places, which, given the fact he has his own book out in a couple of months, is as much praise as I can expect.
Were you one of the reporters who examined the files before The Guardian began to report on them?
Well, that's right. I was one of a small team who looked at this stuff in a secret bunker at The Guardian's HQ in London, just close to King's Cross Station, and we spent many days and weeks interrogating this material, trying to make sense of it.
Well, you've written about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and on the FSB, Russia's Federal Securities Service, the successor to the KGB. You just told me that you're about to go to Crimea. Is this book of a piece of the kind of work that you do?
Well, there is a theme, I guess. I mean, I've done a few books in the last few years. I did write a book with a Guardian colleague on WikiLeaks, and I was part of the team that sifted those famous U.S. State Department cables back in 2010, which I think gave a fascinating insight into kind of U.S. power and diplomacy. And I wrote a book about Russia after I got kicked out in 2011. So that makes the prospect of my meeting Edward Snowden in Moscow rather unlikely, because I'm on a blacklist, I think.
So what's going to happen when you go to Crimea if it's kind of a...
Well, ask me next week.
A Russian satellite.
I mean, it may be Russia by next week.
Yeah, there's actually going to be a vote to...
A vote in inverted commas.
In 10 days.
Yeah, so.
Your first chapter here deals with someone who went by the handle The True Hoo-Ha. That was on the web Ars Technica. Has Edward Snowden ever confirmed that he was the true Hoo-Ha?
He hasn't formally confirmed it, but there are several clues. For example, there are a lot of photos of Edward Snowden which he posts as the true Hoo-Ha when he does this rather unlikely modeling shoot, age 23. It's clearly Snowden. I think he would have disavowed these blog entries by now if they weren't him. Plus Glenn, I think, has more or less confirmed that he is the true Hoo-Ha, or at least he was.
Well, what do these posts tell us about him? This is a much younger Snowden. So is this when he's still a conservative, coming out of a conservative family background?
Well, I write in my book that they're a kind of Bildungsroman, a sort of German novel of youthful experience. In other words, they show how his ideas change and become more sophisticated as he gets older. He starts posting when he's 18. He authors nearly 800 comments, and it's clear to begin with that he is a sort of classic right-wing libertarian from a conservative family, from a military family. His dad was in the Coast Guard for 3 decades, and he sees the world through that prism. Initially, I would say rather a sort of parochial, you know, U.S. prison, but he changes.
He's a kind of a libertarian, Ron Paul's supporter.
And donator. He actually donates to Ron Paul's campaign. Subsequently,
what have his parents said about their son's actions?
Well, mother hasn't said anything, so far as I know. Father has been supportive, has given TV interviews saying that he loves his son. He supports his son. He's been to see him once in Moscow. But the family have kept a relatively low profile, as indeed has Ed Snowden.
Well, politically, how did he go from condemning WikiLeaks and supporting Ron Paul to being a person that some are convinced is a tool of Russians seeking to rebuild the Soviet Union?
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating trajectory, and I think I think two things happened actually. He was in Switzerland, working for the CIA as the kind of infrastructure guy at the mission in Geneva, and he fell out with his superiors, which I think is important because he decided fairly early on that when he was going to do this leak, he wasn't going to take the kind of internal route and complain upwards, but he was going to do something a lot more bold and dramatic.
Because he could have just simply adopted a progressive viewpoint and still kept everything secret.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, he didn't have to. You could change your politics, but not necessarily then make all of this material public.
Well, I don't think he did change his politics. I think he just became disillusioned with what he saw as the kind of NSA's overreach, and he saw more documents as he went along. You can track him going from Switzerland to Japan and then to Hawaii, and had more access. And what he saw troubled him. But I don't think his political views have changed fundamentally. But I think what makes him extraordinary, you mentioned Ellsberg at the beginning, is the fact that he took a kind of very un-Ellsbergian route. In other words, he skipped off to Hong Kong. He was already in contact with journalists. He turned this material over to them. But what he was trying to do, essentially, was to start a debate as over NSA mass surveillance.
And unlike Ellsberg, he didn't go to the New York Times or the Washington Post.
Well, he didn't. He had a big grudge against the Times and the, well, the Times especially, I think less so the Post, because he felt that they had sat on the illegal wiretapping story back in 2004. They eventually published it in 2005, and he saw this as a kind of dereliction of journalism. And so instead he went to people from what you might call the Fifth Estate. So Glenn Greenwald, who was a blogger, and Laura Poitras, who was a filmmaker.
My guest is Luke Harding, who has written The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. Steve Jobs was playing around with blue boxes and hacking the phone system when he was a teen. Did the young Snowden have any high-tech aspirations?
Well, I don't know if he had aspirations, but what he did have was he had amazing skills. This is someone who is from the sort of first generation off the internet. You call them millennials, call them what you like, but people who have an intuitive grasp of how the internet works. He was very, very, very competent. And also, I think, a kind of proprietorial sense that the internet isn't a platform for the Pentagon or for big government, but it's actually a sort of platform for everybody.
Well, much has been made of the fact that he didn't finish high school. Why did he drop out? He's obviously a bright man.
He's very bright. I mean, there are several kind of erratic episodes in his kind of CV, and this is one of them. He got ill in his mid-teens, and at the same time also his parents' marriage imploded, and they divorced, and I think that had a kind of negative effect on his studies.
And then despite his conservative politics, he could have enlisted in the military right after the 9/11 attacks. He was old enough, but he waited until 2004 when he was 21.
Yes, that's another kind of intriguing episode because Ed Snowden is many things, but he doesn't strike me as a kind of special forces soldier. I mean, he's short-sighted. He's got -6 in kind of both eyes. He wears glasses. I mean, he works out, so he's physically very fit, but he's not a kind of bulky guy with a shaven head. And this was a sort of quixotic adventure that misfired. He lasted 2 months, broke his legs, and he was discharged.
But honorably, or whatever it is, not dishonorably discharged.
It was just not, exactly, for medical reasons, but it was just not for him. But you can see the sort of patriotic motor which was driving his thinking even then.
Although he didn't have a college degree, he got a job with the CIA at the age of 23. Were they hiring people who only had a GED?
They were hiring people who had exceptional skills, web skills, computer skills, and that's what Ed Snowden had. And he sort of very quickly grasped that even though if you haven't got a degree, but you can do amazing things on computers, that this opened all sorts of interesting doors for you in the State Department and the CIA and so on. And he kind of gamed it. You follow his posts, and he was at one point he's saying, look, State Department is the place to be right now. And it worked.
Well, he wound up in Europe almost fairly soon afterward. That would be a significant posting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Europe for Ed Snowden was a kind of an adventure and an awakening. He was someone who had just basically been on the East Coast of the States, and suddenly he's based in Switzerland. He's complaining about the hamburgers and the fact that you don't get kind of chilled water on your table immediately. But at the same time, he's kind of enamored of the Swiss attitudes towards liberty. He's riding motorbikes. He's going to Bosnia. He's checking out the local women. I mean, he's having an adventure. I think this was the moment where where Ed's sort of disillusionment slowly began.
And you mentioned that diplomats had little understanding of the internet, but still, was the CIA so short on skilled workers that they needed to send a 24-year-old high school dropout to do security work in Europe?
Well,
there would be a lot of highly sensitive materials there.
Leonard, ultimately, that's a question for the CIA. But I think this is the dilemma, actually, that the NSA and other secret agencies face, is that the world has become so technically complicated that we live in this era of big data. You actually need geeks who can interpret this stuff, who can make it happen. And you're not going to find geeks from people over the age of 40. You're going to find geeks who are bright 20-somethings who may or may not have the kind of formal skills.
Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, remained hidden until she was exposed by Adrian Lemo. But Edward Snowden identified himself almost immediately. Do you know why he chose to go public?
Yes. He was very clear in his dealings with The Guardian, with Glenn, with Ewan McCaskill, my colleague with Laura Poitras, that he didn't want someone else to take the rap for this. He'd seen what happened with previous leak inquiries at the NSA, and this was a kind of torrid experience for people who were suspected of wrongdoing. And so fairly early on, he decided that he would out himself because he wanted to protect his family, his girlfriend. And also, I think he wanted to kind of say, look, I did this, and this is why I've done it, because he knew that that would kind of ignite the debate he wanted.
Was he also aware of what was happening to Manning? A UN special rapporteur on torture said Manning's detention conditions were cruel, inhuman, and degrading. Others have called it torture. But do you think he was worried about being treated that way?
Well, I think he was, and I think this informed his decision to do something different from Manning. I mean, Manning got caught. He also followed the example of Thomas Drake, another whistleblower who complained internally and ended up being arrested at gunpoint, facing 35 years in jail. And so he came up with a new paradigm. I mean, the plan was crazy, but actually it worked.
He was an experienced internet user. Why did he go to Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian rather than to some online group like WikiLeaks?
Leonard, that's a very interesting question. I think he did consider going to WikiLeaks, but he, in my view, quite sensibly rejected this because he felt that Julian Assange was very heavily surveilled. He's stuck in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, clearly a kind of target. But I think he read Glenn's stuff. I think he was part of his community. He saw his blogs and he liked what he read.
And how did Laura Poitras get involved in this?
Well, Laura got involved because when Ed Snowden reached out to Glenn Greenwald and sent this kind of tantalizing email in December 2012.
Under the name Verax.
Yeah, saying, I'm a senior guy in the intelligence community. I've got some stuff you might be interested in. Could you install encryption? And Glenn, who is a terrific guy, a terrific journalist, but also someone who is, let's say, overstretched, just didn't get around to doing it. He's got dogs jumping on his home in Brazil, and he's got 16 chat windows open. He gets 100 emails a day, 200 emails a day. He didn't do it. So after several false starts, Snowden anonymously reached out to Laura, and Laura is much better at the whole tech side and encryption, and they began corresponding.
Well, if Snowden was right about the need for encryption, and if the NSA was monitoring global communications as closely as has been claimed, how did the agency miss Snowden's initial attempts to contact Glenn Greenwald?
Well, they were clearly snoozing, napping, is the politest way of putting it.
But the whole justification for what they're doing is that this will uncover stuff in the huge mass messages they go through the internet.
Well, they also just appear to have missed Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So far as I can tell, they didn't actually see that one coming either, despite their enormous technical...
Well, I was reading about it in the newspaper. All they had to do was read some op-ed pieces.
Right. I mean, read my previous book on Russia. I mean, there were a lot of commentators predicting this, but they're clearly not infallible. And I think Snowden had several advantages. Firstly, they hadn't picked up the distress signals, even though he'd had several run-ins. There were big clues. He was going into the facility in Hawaii wearing a parody NSA T-shirt with a sort of NSA eagle with these kind of headphones on it. But they just thought this was some kind of ironic, cool kids joke. In fact, no, he was deadly serious.
Did he do things to cover up his digital tracks? I mean, he knew the game, so he probably would have been more adept at being able to get past the NSA than I would have.
He knew the game, and plus he was super brilliant at what he was doing. So he was exfiltrating this material. Seemingly, no one noticed. I think several things in his favor. He was sitting in Hawaii, so the time zone worked to his advantage when he was actually roaming through the systems. Fort Meade was sleeping, but also he wasn't on their radar. They missed him, and plus, there are 850,000 people with top secret access, many of them contractors. And so, in a way, you might argue this was an accident, a sort of bomb waiting to go off.
My guest is Luke Harding, an award-winning correspondent for The Guardian, author of three books, now The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man. It's published by Vintage. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guest is Luke Harding. His book, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story and the World's Most Wanted Man, published by Vintage. And you said that Greenwald really wasn't paying as much attention initially. When did he realize that this was important stuff?
He had a meeting with Laura Poitras in spring of last year, where Laura basically said that she thought this guy was genuine, or girl. It wasn't clear at that point who it was. It was an anonymous source. And they met without electronics at a Marriott hotel in New York and basically sketched a way forward if this source was real. And at that point, Glenn was interested, but he was still somewhat skeptical.
And then Snowden, Greenwald, Poitras, and The Guardian's Ewan McCaskill finally met in Hong Kong. So Snowden had left the NSA and now was already on the run?
Snowden had left the NSA, but he hadn't sort of set off his firework.
Because this is when it starts to sound like a spy thriller.
Well, it is. I mean, I wrote my book like a spy thriller because it just felt like the most appropriate genre, to be honest, because he's sitting in Hong Kong. He's in the Mirror Hotel. He's desperately waiting for Laura and Glenn and Ewan to turn up. Glenn is a little reluctant and is sort of sending emails in his kind of lawyerly way saying, what's in it for me? You know, is this really worth my time? But he's being asked to fly halfway around the world on a kind of hunch, essentially. And so what Snowden does, I mean, he's always very strategic. This whole thing, he unfolds this plan bit by bit, is he sort of pumps out documents to Laura, almost as a goodwill gesture, showing that he actually has this material.
And did he explain why Hong Kong, of all places?
Well, subsequently, in the kind of fascinating interview, Guardian video interview, which I think probably pretty much everyone has seen by now, he talks about Hong Kong having a record for free speech. But, of course, it is a sort of counterintuitive choice because Hong Kong's foreign policy is run by Beijing, and Beijing is no democracy. But I also think you have to bear in mind that Snowden was very worried he would be caught before his plane had even taken off. And so Hong Kong was a logical and easy hop from Hawaii.
When Snowden first met with Greenwald and Poitras, how did he want to handle the release of the files?
He was very clear about what he did and didn't want to happen. He had a plan, and his plan was that he would turn this material over to the journalists. They would sift it, and they would publish stuff which spoke directly to the mass surveillance theme, the unconstitutional spying on millions of Americans and others, in Snowden's view. But what he didn't want to do, and he said this explicitly, was to damage legitimate US intelligence operations in Afghanistan, Iran, and other countries around the world. So there was a clear dividing line. And that's where I think he diverges with WikiLeaks. I think had WikiLeaks had this material, they would have published everything. He didn't want everything published.
But Greenwald still didn't want to go along with his total idea. He saw things a little differently and convinced him to do it a little differently.
Well, there was a kind of engagement process. And also, actually, bear in mind that these documents, Leonard, are very hard to read. I mean, now we all know PRISM. We know Boundless Informant. The latest code name was Optic Nerve. But at the time, when you're staring at this mass of top-secret material, it looks as if some of these PowerPoints have been written by Martians. And what Ed Snowden did was sort of help parse them, help deconstruct them, and push the kind of Guardian team in the right direction.
Was the Guardian determined to publish from the minute the editors recognized the importance of the files?
Well, this is where Ewan McCaskill comes in. He was the sort of third musketeer, and his role in the drama has been, he's been somewhat written out in some versions, but essentially Ewan went along. He's a sort of veteran 61-year-old Washington correspondent to verify that Snowden wasn't some sort of fantasist or clever hoaxer. And essentially, he spent a day with him, talking to him, and then he sent out a sort of text back to the editor-in-chief of Guardian US, a woman called Janine Gibson, and Ewan's text read, "The Guinness is good." And that code name meant, if he'd said the Guinness is bad, it's like, no, don't publish. But the Guinness is good meant that we could start to publish this material. And moreover, we could phone the White House and say, look, we have this story.
Didn't Snowden want to issue a kind of grand personal statement? I was thinking of that when that's something that Greenwald talked him out of.
Yeah, he wrote a manifesto. We lost it at some point in this kind of melee, so I didn't read it. But my colleagues in Guardian US read it, and they said it came across as somewhat hyperbolic, a little overwrought. But bear in mind, at this point, they didn't know. Snowden was talking in apocalyptic terms about what would happen when this material was released and what the consequences for him personally would be. But of course, he was on the money. He was right. But at that point, we didn't know that.
Well, did the Guardian want to keep this all for itself, or was it willing to share it with other news organizations?
Well, that's an interesting and delicate question. Glenn was working for The Guardian at the time, but Glenn is very much a free-spirited individual who has partnered this material with other newspapers around the world for maximum impact, which I think is fine. And actually, in the end, because we were being threatened with injunction in London, The Guardian ended up partnering with the New York Times and ProPublica because it was the only way we could keep hold of this material.
My guest is Luke Harding. His book, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, published by Vintage. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the Cameron government, other members of parliament also threatened legal action against The Guardian. Did they ever threaten other actions like closing the newspaper?
Yeah, David Cameron sent his kind of top emissary, someone called Sir Jeremy Hayward, who's the cabinet secretary, the most powerful official in the UK, to come and see us secretly. And he did at one point mutter about some people in government want you closed down. But the whole thing became very bizarre because there were more and more threats from Downing Street, from Cameron, that if we didn't hand this material back, the police would basically come in and seize the computers.
But this came at a rather embarrassing time for Cameron, didn't it? Because it was around the same time The Guardian was exposing the Murdoch Papers hacking scandal. Did that help or hurt?
Well, let's say David Cameron is not a fan of The Guardian. I mean, we're a progressive, left-leaning newspaper. David Cameron presides over a government of right-wing multimillionaires.
He likes The Express better.
Many of whom went to Eton. His morning paper is The Telegraph or The Times, I think. Although at one point, Jeremy Hayward, his emissary, did say to Alan Rusbridger, my editor, he said that David Cameron cares a lot more about The Guardian than some American blogger. The some American blogger was Glenn Greenwald, of course.
Mm. Well, since Britain doesn't have a written constitution, does not have the equivalent of a First Amendment, how does that play in something like this?
Well, firstly, I think we need one. I think this whole Snowden episode, kind of, for us, for investigative journalists in the UK, we feel very vulnerable and naked compared to our US colleagues. And secondly, that just the end of that story is that we ended up smashing our own computers in the basement of The Guardian under government duress, watched by two spies from GCHQ, the British spy agency, who took photos on their iPhones and then went back to provincial England.
Well, how could the government get away with that? Was this legal?
Well, there's been the political mood has been very different in the UK. There's been a big campaign by some on the right to essentially criminalise what we've been doing, to criminalise Snowden reporting. And there's an ongoing police investigation into us, well, actually into some people, Scotland Yard says. And this makes us feel uneasy. We don't know where this is going, but it doesn't look very good.
Well, so the hard drives were destroyed. But the material had been sent elsewhere. So was this just a symbolic thing?
We explained this very painstakingly to the government that this was pointless. And I call it in my book, I say it was half Stasi, the East German secret police, and half pantomime. So it was both comedic and chilling, I would say.
Well, this is we've been hearing now about the GCHQ collecting webcam images of thousands of Yahoo viewers. So I guess what's happening is that they felt this was perhaps getting a little too close to home.
Yeah. One of the things Ed Snowden said to Ewan McCaslin in Hong Kong, Ewan said, look, what about the British? Have they got any role in this huge global NSA-led spying operation? And Ewan was taken aback by Snowden's response, which was that actually the British are more intrusive than the NSA, if that's believable. But now we've seen the documents, we know it's true.
Well, opinion on Edward Snowden is deeply divided in this country. How's he seen in Britain and throughout Europe?
It depends on which country you ask. In Germany, he's basically a hero, and a lot of people want Angela Merkel to give him asylum, give him refuge, not least because Angela Merkel's own phone was hacked for a decade by the NSA, apparently without Obama knowing. In Britain, it's a different vibe. It's only, I would say, in the last few months that politicians in the UK have seriously started discussing this.
Despite the fact that Britain is the source of the material.
Yeah, and it's been fascinating to follow from afar the debate here, which I think has been pretty exemplary. I listened to Obama's speech in January where he announced reforms in inverted commas to the way the NSA operates. And I think a lot of what he said were basically minor tweaks, but it did appear like a sincere attempt to kind of engage with this whole privacy versus security debate.
Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, Republican Representative John Boehner, both called the leaks an act of treason. Some have also denounced Glenn Greenwald. In the United States, there's been a lot of crossover between Democrats and Republicans over the leaks. How did Labor and the Tories deal with this? Was there a party split?
Well, the Tories, a lot of backbench Tories have appeared on TV talk shows saying that we should all go to jail, basically, that we've been very bad, we've committed espionage, and now we should be punished by the law. And it's been pretty primitive, pretty jejune stuff. And the Labour Party, until quite recently, has sort of said nothing. It's sat on its hands because Labour is just as complicit as the Tories in spying a lot of these programs. Tempora, for example, where GCHQ, like NSA, hacks fiber optic cables, was signed off by Labour foreign secretaries.
And then, of course, Britain has more cameras monitoring the public than any other country in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I try and explore in my book. Why is it that the Brits just don't care about their civil liberties? You know, is it because of James Bond jumping out of helicopters and rescuing the Queen from time to time? Is it just our kind of literary and filmic culture? Or is it our lack of constitution? Or is it just that we're just kind of deferential fools who just accept what the state does?
In August, police detained, that's last year, Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, at Heathrow Airport. And Laura Poitras says that she routinely goes to great lengths to avoid American seizure of her equipment. Do either the United States or UK governments continue to pressure you or other Guardian journalists?
Well, there's this ongoing criminal investigation, like I said, into the Snowden material and the journalists who work with it. The David Miranda case was, in my view, a really egregious thing because essentially he was flying back from seeing Laura in Berlin, heading back to Rio. He was carrying encrypted material, but he was stopped at the airport under draconian anti-terrorism legislation, which is supposed to be used for for jihadists, for al-Qaeda, and it was clear that he didn't fall into that category. So I think it's worrying.
Well, The Guardian has offices in the United States. Should I assume that most of the material is now reposing here?
Yeah, although it's not with The Guardian US in Broadway, just down the road from here. It's at the New York Times, with whom we partner, which seems to be the securest place it could be.
Jacob Applebaum helped to produce a Der Spiegel report on NSA monitoring technology. He urges all journalists to use tools to maintain anonymity and privacy over digital communications. Is The Guardian doing anything like that?
Well, Jake's right. I met him in Berlin, and since talking to Jake, I've raised my game, security-wise. We've raised our game. I mean, a year ago, we didn't use encrypted chat or PGP. Now we all do. A year ago, we would take our phones into meetings. Now we just dump them outside. We've really slipped through a wormhole back to the pre-internet age, where we have face-to-face meetings. We're thinking about carrier pigeons. I mean, because electronics are out. And you've even got diplomats in London now using typewriters. It's like the 1950s.
In December, the first American federal court to assess the legality of the NSA program in a public adversarial proceeding ruled that it's probably unconstitutional. Well, you can't do that in Britain, but have there been any legal decisions in Britain on the legality of GCHQ surveillance?
Well, it's a very good question, but the spies and the government insist that everything is legal, and it complies with existing legislation. But the problem is that the laws to regulate GCHQ were drafted in a pre-internet age where Google was still in its infancy, Facebook didn't exist, going back to 2000, and clearly they need to be reworked.
Well, do you think that the British experience with the IRA and then other terrorist experiences have left Britons more inclined to accept surveillance?
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, we had our own terrorism problem. But no one is objecting to NSA, GCHQ spying on terrorists, on bad guys and al-Qaeda, on the Russian government, for example. I mean, that's what they should be doing. So that's okay. I think what we object to, what Snowden objects to, is the bulk collection of data from ordinary people.
So in the end, what is the fallout from all of this? There's been a certain amount of embarrassment. We have learned that there is surveillance of world leaders.
Of you and me.
In the end, it doesn't seem to have affected much. I don't know if any jihadists have been caught or not caught because of what Snowden did. Is this really just a matter of revealing something that Snowden felt should be revealed and nothing more than that?
Well, I think there are two things going on here. There's one, that Snowden is the guy who kind of pulled away the curtain to show us the true nature of things, the fact that in 2014, 2013, all of our personal information has been collected. So this throws up fundamental questions about, for us, for our children, for our children's children, can we expect any electronic privacy going forward? But there's a separate element, which is, are the agencies, our governments going to change this? To which the answer is probably not, but let's see.
But has what Snowden has done endangered anybody? That, I guess, was what I was trying to ask.
Well, this is said routinely. I heard General Alexander speaking in Washington earlier this week, and he said this again, but there's never any evidence offered for this assertion that national security has been damaged. We've been very careful to redact names, not to publish stuff on operations, and also to engage with the White House, with NSA, with the relevant agencies before we publish.
Luke Harding's latest book is The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. It is published by Vintage. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.